You're listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. I remember with great pleasure the last time Leslie Marmon Silko was here. It was over 10 years ago. I remember her speaking about the global movement of people and animals and the impossibility of borders. Her words have continued to inform me over the years, and I was delighted when I learned that she had a new book out this fall, a memoir called The Turquoise Ledge. It's a self-portrait steeped in Native American storytelling traditions that explores the spiritual world of her ancestors and describes with beauty and precision her current Sonoran Desert surroundings. In fact, she just found a little piece of the Sonoran Desert in her pocket in the green room, which is very nice. Writer Joy Williams calls The Turquoise Ledge a classic of desert writing. Silko's fresh, vivid correspondence with beings so refreshingly not us is as restorative as desert rain. She blesses us. Leslie Marmon Silko was born in New Mexico in 1948 and grew up in the Pueblo of Laguna, located in west central New Mexico. She published her first novel, Ceremony, in 1978. Sherman Alexie described it as the greatest novel in Native American literature. Her other works include Storyteller, Almanac of the Dead, and a book of essays, Yellow Woman, and Beauty of the Spirit, And she is recipient of many grants and awards, including a MacArthur Fellowship, and we are very happy to welcome her back to the Aloud series. In conversation with Leslie tonight, we have Judith Freeman, who is also a woman of the West, a native of Utah, I believe, a resident of Los Angeles and rural Idaho. She's a novelist and critic whose works include The Chinchilla Farm, Set for Life, which won the Western Heritage Award, Red Water, named one of the 100 best books of 2003 by the LA Times, and her nonfiction book, which I would guess many of you are familiar with, The Long Embrace, Raymond Chandler and the Woman He Loved, was chosen by Newsweek as one of the top 10 books published in 2007, and after you read it, Los Angeles will never feel the same. Please welcome Leslie Marmon Silko and Judith Freeman. Thank you.
Good evening and welcome. Thank you for coming out tonight. What I'd like to do is just start out with a little bit of reading from The Turquoise Ledge. I decided a couple of years ago when I was 60 that if I were ever going to do anything with my little notes about that I had made about my encounters with the various desert animals, I'd better get started. And then I realized that the world was changing so fast, and I realized that if I didn't do it, no one would know, and I wanted other generations to know a different way of being before there were all sorts of electronic and digital things connecting them. And I believe it's a kind of oppression, actually. And so I wanted to do that, and I decided it was about time. Of course, I've always been most comfortable with fiction, and so after I agreed to do this book and started working on it, a number of times I said to myself, "What were you thinking? Why did you say you would do this?" And so it's got all sorts of things in it, but one of the things I decided to do was I wanted while I was writing it to I wanted it to be soothing and peaceful, and I'm really horrified and sickened by what's happened in this country and the screaming heads, and what I wanted to do was completely get away from that if I could. Of course, if you read the book, you see towards the end that you aren't exactly able to escape all of that. But anyway, and then there were some parts about my ancestors that were pretty hair-raising. But anyway, enough of that. Let me just read to you a little bit, and then we can start our dialogue. This is from chapter 15. The drought began in 1985. The small cottonwood tree I planted in 1989 died in the summer of 1997. The tree depended on gray water from the kitchen sink, but I did very little cooking and washing while I completed my novel, Gardens in the Dunes. The last good rains came in 1983 from a hurricane that came out of the Gulf of California. The rivers and arroyos that were usually dry suddenly filled with torrents of water that swept over their banks and washed away bridges and condominiums. The approach of rain clouds on the horizon became an important occasion. I'd stop whatever I was doing, including writing, and sit outside to wait for the clouds and hope they wouldn't pass us over. In 1997, I started writing little notes about the sky, the clouds, and all us desert creatures anxious to have the rain. The first rain of any duration came stealthily around the 10th of May that year. No weather radar map showed any clouds, even when I could see the clouds and the wind blew. I didn't look outside again for hours until I noticed the sky darkening. I left art magazines and a VCR outside in the yard as an unwitting offering to the rain. And I brought the items indoors then and worried that I'd offended the rain clouds. Actually, I was cleaning and I left them out and I thought about leaving, then I chickened out. To leave valuable possessions outside indicates the wretched hopelessness felt after years of drought. Clouds, please take pity on us. 10 days later, the northeast sky is violet blue. The spin of the storm spiraled it north, but now we may be in its path if it begins to spin southward. But it didn't spin southward after all. No rain. The air is so dry, even if rain did fall from the clouds in a gossamer veil of blue, it would evaporate before it reached the ground. Here I abandoned the rain journal for a while. A superstitious person might say, don't keep a rain journal because it won't rain if you do. Even the chance for rain puts me in the mood to write about the approaching clouds. They are so lovely, I want to sketch them in chalk too. If I kept a heat journal, I would have a great deal to write about every day. Temperatures above 103 degrees overheat the ape brain, and humans become slightly crazed. Minor traffic accidents increase in Tucson. Those of us with overheated monkey brains brook no delays at traffic lights or in supermarket checkout lines. Newcomers to Tucson's summer heat are amazed to find their car's rearview mirror lying on the front seat because the glue melts. Car windshields become solar furnaces capable of melting plastic objects left on the car dashboards, including cell phones, sunglasses, cameras, DVDs, and credit cards. Dashboards themselves gradually crack and disintegrate. Car batteries suddenly explode. Transformers on electric power poles also explode in the heat. During daylight hours, the dash from the air-conditioned supermarket to the car wilts all fresh produce or cut flowers and defrosts frozen food. So the wise shopper waits until the night. So do the wise hunters. Night, heavenly, delicious, sweet night of the desert that calls all of us out. sweet night of the desert that calls all of us out to love her. The night is our comfort with her coolness and darkness. On wings, on feet, on our bellies, out we all come to glory in the night. There are a few deserts on earth that go without measurable rainfall or snow for years and years, and not just 6 or 7 months as Tucson does. Places in the Taklamakan Desert on the Old Silk Road and the Atacama Desert in Chile, they get less rain than Tucson does. Places in Iraq and Arabia get hotter than Tucson. Even Phoenix and Las Vegas get hotter than Tucson. Over time, the monkey brain adjusts to the temperatures above 102 Fahrenheit, but there are compensations which must be made. Long before there was any such thing as daylight savings time, the people of the desert Southwest got out of bed long before dawn, at midnight if the moon was up, to work in their cornfields until daylight. By noon, the people would be asleep. The Englishmen saw this and accused the people of laziness, but to work in the heat at high noon, as the old gringos did, was madness. Tucson nights in the summer approach a perfection of temperature between the night air and that of the human body. The air is faintly perfumed by the Reina de la Noche, the Queen of the Night, an indigenous variety of the night-blooming Cereus cactus that bears blossoms of astonishing beauty which last only one night. The light of the moon on the desert causes subtle motion to become perceptible as the giant saguaros move in the wind along the ridge. It all happens with the light. What we see, what the human brain registers, what we call reality, is all light.
I feel like it's fortuitous that we have some rain for you.
Yes, yes. I'm hoping to pack some up and take it back with me.
As you can tell from that passage that Leslie just read, this is really an exquisitely beautiful memoir, The Turquoise Ledge. It's also one of the most unusual memoirs that I've read ever, but especially in this particular moment of memoir where so much has become so personal. And in this memoir, one of the really amazing things is that it creates such a pattern of life. And that, yes, it's about you and your life, but it's equally about the insects and the snakes and the birds and the plants and the clouds and the very earth itself. It's a memoir about everything that has surrounded you for all these years.
I actually feel that they are part of my life, and I feel diminished if they're harmed. Mm-hmm. And I think they've sustained me, and I really believe that about the wild world and all the creatures.
And one of the things that you're looking at, of course, the title comes from the idea that this area where you've lived for 30 years now on a ranch that's in the mountains just outside of Tucson, you began taking walks up a big arroyo. And part of the reason for the walks, or part of what happened, is that you began looking for turquoise and picking up bits of rocks and bits of turquoise on your walks. And this really becomes a very fluid and beautiful part of the book. And I wonder if you could talk for just a moment to this idea of turquoise and what it's meant particularly for indigenous people on the American continent, and where it came from.
Well, turquoise, of course, when you often in the 60s and 70s, it be turquoise jewelry and Southwestern jewelry became, you know, I rewarded myself by buying this bracelet after I finished the book. But it's been connected with the Southwest, and it has great meaning because the people valued it and connected it with water and rain. And then when I started doing my research, I found out that the formation of turquoise with the various minerals occurs at a very shallow level in earth and depends on water. And so this connection of turquoise with water because of the color, it actually has validity with the science of its formation. And I had always assumed that there was a lot of turquoise in Mexico, because you see that it's very important to the Mayans and the Nahua people. But then after I started doing some reading, I discovered that these magnificent mosaics that are in the British Museum, they're the only surviving mosaics that were taken by the conquistadors back to Europe from the Mayan and Nahua or Aztec people, that when they did an analysis of the turquoise in the mosaics, that the turquoise came from near Santa Fe, New Mexico, and that actually Mexico only has one small source of turquoise. And of course, that explains why between Mexico City and Santa Fe, there was actually like a road or highway. And the what we learned in school from American history, that the brave European explorers had to find their way north, is complete baloney. That these were very well-marked trade paths that had carried commerce, the macaw feathers and beautiful and living macaws north, and then they would trade for the turquoise, which they so highly prized for the rituals in the south. And so on my walks, one of the reasons that ever since I had arrived in Tucson, I had noticed these bits of turquoise, and I had picked up some of them. But when I first got to Tucson, I was riding horseback, and so I didn't always want to get off the horse and pick them up. But then after my poor last horse passed away and I decided I needed a cardiovascular workout, I started walking. And of course, walking, you can pick these pieces up. And in the Tucson Mountains, the soil and sand and earth are very light colored because they're volcanic ash. And so these pieces of turquoise are almost iridescent and they stand out. And so I started picking them up and learning about them. And I choose to call all of it turquoise or turquoise stone, though technically there's a continuum of that formation of those minerals. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what I've picked up was considered soft turquoise, mm-hmm. or the scientific name is chrysocolla. Mm-hmm. But chrysocolla sounds like a soft drink.
It does.
And so I decided I just would call it all turquoise because in the old days people did.
And it's, you know, it is such a it's such a powerful color. And one of the things that you're looking at is how it is formed in this shallow way. But the turquoise ledge that you began to discover actually runs underneath your ranch. I mean, you discover that in your driveway or down by the horse corrals, there are these little outcroppings. And to me, what's so beautiful about this book is I've often thought it would be terrific to just come to know one small part of the world, to hike it, to walk it, whether it's in the Santa Monica Mountains, whether it's in Idaho, whether it's in the Southwest. But to take the time to really carefully look and explore and think about and really embrace just one small part of the world, your part of the world, And it seems to me that you've done so thoroughly that in this book, that it's the very foundation of as you've said, your life. And yet, there are parts of the book that really deal with your childhood, which was a very special and unique childhood growing up in the Laguna Pueblo as a person of mixed ancestry, white, Mexican, and Laguna. And it seemed to me that it was such an intimate and close world that your grandfather had a store across the road from the house where you lived with your parents, and your father worked in the store, and your mother, who was also a home economics teacher, but she also worked in the store because there was a little post office in the corner.
She was a postmaster, yeah.
And your grandmother, Lily, and your aunt, Susie, and all of the women in your family who took you and raised you, and what a close, intimate, extraordinary world. And you write about it in such a vivid way. But it becomes a small part of the book, really. Mm-hmm. I know at one point you said that you had decided before you started this memoir that you wanted as much as possible to avoid unpleasantness and strife and politics. So there's this great feeling that flows through the memoir of gratitude. And can you talk a little bit about that, why you made that decision and how the memoir became what it is?
Well, once I had decided that I would do it and the book contract was signed and so forth, and I started to work, it was in 2006, and it just seemed like there was just the whole sort of political scene and the general public scene was so divisive and ugly and horrible. And I thought, I can't stand it, and I'm not going to talk about it, and I don't want my readers to have to suffer with it. And I'm pretty fed up with human beings right now. And I think that human beings have just gotten completely, have a very extravagant and ridiculous sense of importance in this world where all living beings contribute to our humans continuing. And I decided, rather than to write something like what I just said, I would implicitly, in other words, I would, by how I approach this memoir, I would implicitly state that I was fed up with human beings, yes, most human beings. And so that's what I decided to do, to leave the attitudes and feelings and those sorts of things underneath. So it wasn't as if I was trying to ignore them, but I wanted them to be implicit in the structure of the memoir, and that's why it's so different. And I love to move from, it's taken me a long time to come to the genre called the memoir, and of course we snicker sometimes when someone said, well, now I'm going to go work on my memoirs. And we know that a lot of memoirs are ghostwritten, and if the memoirs of politicians and Hollywood stars are, complete fictions. But I was interested in what I could do, and I really did want it to be different, but I desperately wanted to give my readers and myself a break. And I decided, you know what? I want my readers to know what really moves me, what heals me, what keeps me going, what I love with all my heart. And it's this. Uh-huh. So that's how I got going on it.
It's quite an unusual decision to make at a point when so many memoirs are really capitalizing on the idea of being a victim. And I found it so refreshing myself. Because as you say, it's a difficult time. It's a very stressful time we're living in, and there's a great deal of fear and anxiety. And what I sensed in this memoir, and it's your first book in a number of years.
Yes, 10 years.
10 years.
Yes.
And you could have chosen to write fiction. You could have chosen to write a different kind of memoir. You could have chosen not to write at all. But instead, you've produced this really meticulously, beautifully observed chronicle of life, and it's a kind of a, you know, a phrase that you've used before is the great and inclusive pattern of everything that's in a life. And one of the things I was curious about is that you live not isolated, but you know, a little bit away from the city, and you have two sons who are grown. And when one lives outside of cities and you're a writer, you're spending a lot of time alone. And it seemed to me like you're very comfortable with that, but you've also learned how to use that aloneness to really sit and watch clouds. It's very hard to have a relationship with clouds until you make the decision that you're really going to sit and look at the sky and be very observant. So this gives you a lot of comfort. Is it difficult to have grown up in such a great, big, sort of inclusive, extended family, and to spend so much time alone now?
Well, not really. One of the wonderful things about the Pueblo when I was growing up was that people were allowed to be themselves. And I knew of a couple of older women who mostly kept to themselves, not in a hostile way, but they spent a lot of time. Their husbands were either dead, or in Aunt Alice's case, Uncle Mike lived in California and came home about 3 times a year. He worked on the railroad. But when I was a little girl, those women would be busy outside, and they would keep doing what they were doing when I approached, and I would be very quiet, and I would just watch them, and they understood. And then later on, like Aunt Alice would be doing something, she might make a comment to let me know why she did that, or Aunt Susie would say something about what she was doing. And I somehow, as a little tiny girl, somehow understood their pleasure and their happiness and what they were doing alone. And one of the things in the Pueblo was that the rest of the village would say, well, so-and-so, that's what she likes to do. And that's different, yes, but that's all right. You know, there was a great tolerance for individual people. And so I never felt that they were odd or strange. And I understood that one could choose that. And I think by spending so much time with these women who were so happy with the solitude, that I understood that there was a permission for that. Mm-hmm. But I must say that the 10 years I spent writing Almanac of the Dead, those 10 years of writing every day, I think that was the sort of breakthrough for me with the solitude. And no one ever told me when I was in school, no one ever tells you in creative writing classes that every book that you write will change you, that you will never be the same. And I didn't understand that exactly. And then after Almanac of the Dead, I understood. Then that was when I really was able to revert to the kind of the happiness and solitude that I had sort of sensed or learned when I was a little girl from these women. And I understood it was permitted and respected. And years later, I made some remark to a person from Hopi Pueblo about almost sort of half apologetically about, you know, staying apart, even though I knew at Laguna it was permitted. And it's understood that some people are called to spend longer expanses of alone than others, mm-hmm. and that it's good. It's somehow good for others. You're not being selfish.
Yes.
But that it's good for everyone that certain people spend this time contemplating or being alone.
You know, it's so interesting to think of some of the really strong differences between white and native cultures and the way that we think. And I think that's part of it, but I also was struck by the way you talk about there isn't such a strict division in sexes in Pueblo culture. Women can do men's jobs. Children can be raised by fathers or uncles. I mean, women,
exactly.
Girls. That there aren't these strange prohibitions that we often find. One of the things I find in your memoir is a, you know, because I was raised in the West too, and my family settled in Arizona, where you now live, even though you were born near Albuquerque.
Mm-hmm.
My ancestors came into the country in the 1850s. And I tell a very quick story is that when I was writing my novel, Red Water, and I was doing research the first year that the Mormons came into the Salt Lake Valley. And, of course, they had nothing, and it was going to be winter, and Brigham Young and a few, you know, hardy sort of pioneers were quickly building log cabins. But this was Paiute and Ute country, and there had been some fur trappers there, but they were really the first whites. And they decided that they would have a war on the wasters and the destroyers. And they decided to make it a contest. And the wasters and destroyers were everything from bears and cougars and foxes and coyotes, anything that could kill their stock or anything, you know, that they perceived as a waster and destroyer. And within a period of 3 months, they had killed 15,000 wasters and destroyers in 3 months. And that when whites came into the West, they killed 30 million buffalo. When you try and just put your head around that number of 30 million. This is something that would never happen with a Ute or a Laguna or a Hopi or a Navajo, that kind of slaughter, mass slaughter of animals is just, it's unthinkable, isn't it?
It's shocking.
It's great waste, and yet they were calling them the wasters and the destroyers.
And injecting themselves on others.
Yeah, and I must say that now I'm going to get to another part of your book, which has to do with rattlesnakes, and it's a subject that I have feelings about, and that I was so changed by your book, I will never ever be the same. And I want you to read a passage tonight so that you and the audience can also maybe be changed. I wanted to say that where I live, there are a lot of rattlesnakes, and over the last 5 or 6 years, there have been rattlesnakes on the front porch and the back porch and in the driveway and in the garden, and we've killed every one of them.
Oh, dear.
And I just can't tell you the kind of shame I felt in reading your book and realizing not only do you not kill rattlesnakes, but you recognize them. They're rattlesnakes that have lived for a long time under your house, next to your house, by the corrals, by the water dishes. You had 5 mastiffs, I think, about the biggest...
6 mastiffs.
biggest dogs that you can get.
Mm-hmm.
And you have macaws, and you have animals. You had horses for many, many years. So my justification was if I'm... You know, the white part of my background said, the settler part said, if they're in your yard, you have to kill them. If they're out in a field, I would never think of killing a rattlesnake. But if I step outside the door and it's coiled and it's there, then we... And I know you have killed a rattlesnake
before.
Oh,
yes, I confess. I confess
so
my sins.
Even though I have terrible sins, there's still hope for my reform.
Yes, there's always hope for reform.
And the thing is, after reading Leslie's book, I looked at my husband and I said, I will never kill another rattlesnake in my life. So if your book has done nothing else, it's made me not a snake killer. It's made me more than that. It's changed my consciousness to some degree. But I would like you to read just, you know, page 111, a little bit from chapter 20 we can hear. But I especially want you to read the last passage.
Do you want me to read all of it, or do you want me to...
Let's read from the top of page 113.
Okie doke.
And I should say the beautiful thing about this book, too, is that there are wonderful little insects and snakes and ants and that run throughout the book as a kind of illustration between chapters. It's really quite wonderful.
Those are my little drawings. But if you order the electronic version, they're not included. Sherman Alexie showed me last night that they left the little bugs
out.
They
left the bugs off. How terrible.
Forget that. You better buy the book. Okay, I'm going to read. For the past two mornings, a small rattler was coiled by the potted fig tree. Yesterday, the little snake was on the shady side of the fig tree, but today it faced east. Not long after I came indoors, I heard angry, loud rattling that made the dogs bark. I went to see, and there was nothing there to harass the snake, nothing to account for the little snake's furious rattling, except for the sun. The snake was rattling angrily at the sun's heat that only got hotter and hotter as it rattled, until finally the snake fled into the drain pipe that goes underground. I saved a small rattlesnake from the pit of the old cistern last year. But this time, when I saw a small snake down there, I delayed because the weather wasn't hot yet, and I thought maybe the snake wanted to be there where little mice also live. Alas, when I went to check on the snake later, it was stretched out dead. In no time, the hungry creatures of the desert happily consumed it. And then there's a little bug to show you that we're going to a different thing. It's July 6th, and the wildfires in the Catalina Mountains have filled the entire valley with smoke. On the night of July 4th, the flames came over the crest of the mountains and spread down toward the city, dwarfing the fireworks displays there. That was the night the rattlesnakes disappeared underground, where six inches of dirt over your head will save you from wildfire. And then there's a little figure of a snake. Here are some of the practical measures people can take to safely live side by side with rattlesnakes in the Sonoran Desert. Look first before you reach into a flower pot. They hold cool dampness and provide shady spaces for rattlesnakes to rest during the day. Always provide a water bowl, far away from the dog's water bowl, far from the paths humans and pets take, and keep the water bowl full so the snakes never need to come close to your garden path or doorstep for water. Keep your pathways and walks open and well swept so you have a clear view at all times. Keep paths and steps well lit. Watch where you step. Look behind yourself before you step backwards. I have a sketch for a snake house for the garden made with five rectangular pieces of gray slate from south of Laguna, but any flat stones will do. This gives the snakes shady sanctuary so they will feel secure. If you give the snakes a secluded, cool area in the summer, you will seldom see them elsewhere. Over time, the rattlesnakes will get to know you and your pets. They learn human and dog behavior and seem to understand the timing of our daily routines. They try to avoid encounters with us at all cost. A few times I've been very early or very late with my outdoor chores, and I've surprised the snakes that didn't expect me at that time of day. The rattlesnakes that live in your garden or under your house will prevent unfamiliar rattlesnakes from moving too close until they learn how to get along with humans and dogs. Unfamiliar snakes are usually refugees from the real estate developers' bulldozers that scrape the desert bare and kill everything in their path. Understandably, these uprooted snakes may be edgy, so back off. Give them space. They will learn quickly that you mean no harm.
So, there you go. If you want to build snake houses in your yard, you could just do that. But just the idea of having relationships with animals, with reptiles, with bees, with grasshoppers, with all of the creatures that live near us and observing them. I think that one of the things that I was aware of in your book is that the pace at which, now you were fast walking in the big arroyo.
Right.
But you were also looking and walking, and I got the feeling that sometimes you slowed down or you stopped and you're just looking. So, you know, the tremendous speed of the 20th century, the invention of speed and the way our lives are being pushed so fast, it's very hard to have relationships with your environment if you're moving so fast. And so I feel like that's another quality to the book that I really took away, is that you really have to be able to slow down in order to look.
Well, it's really important, just practically speaking, if you're moving through, if you don't have a trail or a clear view, the more slowly you move, the more you give an opportunity for the snakes to get out of your way. Mm-hmm. And it's when you rush through an area or when the dogs go bolting through, that's when the snake has, you know, no way out. And if you're going right over the top of it very fast, that's when accidents can happen. Although on my walks, I don't walk that fast. And a couple of times, I've been right over one and I've had to just like step over or sort of leap over. But what's really wonderful too, and what's important, is you must get the idea of murder and killing out of your consciousness in order for the bees and the snakes to come. And I think the reason on some of my walks when I actually had to step over or jump over the snakes on the trail, and they didn't move and they didn't rattle and they sure didn't try to harm me, is because in the walking and being there, it's so important to let the feeling of, sort of positive happiness and confidence. Mm-hmm. You have to have confidence and faith and trust that mm-hmm. you will not be harmed because you mean no harm.
Exactly. And that really comes down to the thing that you have talked about, that everything really does come down to relationships. It's what we write about. It's what we deal with. It's not only our relationships with our families and our loved ones and our peers and our coworkers, but it's our relationships with the animals around us and with how we really relate to the world. Again, it's a very different consciousness between, a white consciousness, white European consciousness, and a native consciousness. And I think that our defining myth of the snake and the Garden of Eden as being, you know, a really malevolent figure. It ended the idol, the snake, so to speak. It was the seducer. But not all cultures have that negative view of snakes.
Well, even the old European cultures in Romania and Macedonia, Italy, what was once called Yugoslavia and Eastern Europe. Whoops. Mm-hmm. Before in 4,000, 5,000 BC, a lot of the artifacts that they've discovered are these beautiful ceramic Madonnas that have human bodies and hands, but the heads of snakes, and they hold babies mm-hmm. that are like that. And that in Latvia, the snakes were believed to be good luck, and everyone wanted a black snake to guard the house. Mm-hmm. And so it's actually very recently in many ways that this antipathy towards snakes was developed. Mm-hmm. And of course, the Buddhists in the Far East have a philosophy of not harming and mm-hmm. and killing, but by relaxing, it really changes. I think it's harmful to our human bodies to have that kind of feeling. And you know, the snakes and animals, you know, horses, animals are very sensitive, and I think we humans are too. Mm-hmm. And it's extremely trying and exhausting to be in the presence of that kind of negative energy. And
it comes up so easily for us, and it comes up all the time.
Right. In this culture, it's kind of,
it kind of is
conditioned.
Our daily bread now is, you
know. Well, how do you get the NFL, you know? Now they're worried about concussions. And I'm glad that they are. I'm tired that our health costs are run up because professional football creates all these poor people at a young age whose their brains have been turned to mashed potatoes.
Don't you sometimes look at the, you know, the spectacle and think of the Romans and think of the diversions and the spectacles that is, you know, people can very easily get. I'm not a great sports fan, so I'm, you know, I'm sort of outside that, but just the distraction and diversion from the tremendous, tremendous problems, you know, that we face. But it's so much easier to just sort of have your attention diverted by something
else. Well, it isn't just to divert us from the problems. If people were happy watching bees or hummingbirds, or if people were happy just feeling the wind, they wouldn't be such consumers. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't be picking up their blackberries and all this other crap that they're selling us. Mm-hmm. So that consumerism depends upon this severing this relationship with the, you know, with the beauty and the kind of leisurely natural rhythms of the earth and things around us, and it's killing us, you know. Mm-hmm. And I had a for years, I had some old lizards, some iguanas, and my lizard veterinarian told me about research that he had worked on marine iguanas in off the coast of Mexico in the Pacific. And these marine iguanas live on these little rock islands, and they have no natural enemies. Humans can't get out there and so forth. And what they were intrigued about was they had no natural enemies, and yet they didn't have spikes in population and die-offs. So the researchers began to study, and what they discovered was when the density of lizards on these rocks got to be so much that one lizard was bumping another, the stress caused tumors and killed them. Wow. And so stress, you know, and what we've created with this these diversions and this these things that are designed to make us need these other sorts of things, need a new video game or need a new this or that, when we can simply enjoy simple beauties, that flies in the face of the agenda that the consumerists and capitalists have. And so it's a huge obstacle that exists for us. And so I have sympathy. You know, I'm not condemning people, but you can see how it works and how all of these forces of advertising and just everything around us, even when, you know, I had to finally, my Canon word processor, they quit making them after 4 years. I was shocked. And we're forced into buying. So I had to buy a laptop. And then pretty soon, when my printer died and I got a new printer, I found out that my laptop needed to be upgraded because printers wouldn't work with it. And it's this horrible pushing us around by this stupid technology. It's part, and so, you know, to to be happy to use a pencil and a piece of paper, you know, that's not good enough. Or to be happy looking, you know, looking at the bees and, you know, not worrying whether we need a better, you know, better face cream or something like that. You know, we're not allowed anymore. There's this tremendous very narrowing of what we human beings are, in a sense, permitted to do or enjoy. And it's really important to on purpose try to fly in the face of it. Even taking 10 years between books, you know, the publishers want you to crank one out every, you know, every 18 months or every 24 months. And I refuse to be a machine. And, you know, I think that what we need to do is to oppose this very quietly, just in little ways. And even just moving more slowly or, you know, watching the bees or the hummingbirds or the ocean or the clouds, that in some way to me is a positive step against this kind of thing that's happened to us.
It's funny how we used to talk, I mean, in the 50s and the 60s, that idea of built-in obsolescence was very concerning to a lot of people. They were saying, look how fast this junk is, you know, wearing out or breaking down, and you know, it's got built-in obsolescence, and that's not a good thing. But now we don't even think about. We are absolutely at a point where most people accept the fact that your latest electronic device will be supplanted by something in 3 months or 6 months, and without concern for the garbage that's, you know, created. But I want to just mention briefly that you are also a painter, and that in this book, as you are writing your memoir, you're also making these really wonderful paintings, as I can envision them, of what you call the star being portraits. And when you live in the country and you're aware of the night sky, it's not very hard. Much of a leap to begin to have a relationship with that
exactly.
Celestial world. And so the star being portraits were fascinating to me, because this idea of something almost really, you know, beyond our understanding, but not beyond our ability to intuit a relationship
exactly
with these beings. And the portraits that you were painting were also really informing and interacting and having a relationship with the book that you were writing. And I wrote down a passage because you're being so attuned to this sense of otherness. The star beings find the human appetite for novelty stupid and pathetic and a threat to human survival, because the flow of the new and newer is not infinite and can easily be interrupted or stopped by natural causes, never mind terrorism or war. So, you know, there is this feeling that it's not sustainable. It's just not sustainable. And I find people in the country are really equipping themselves for what they feel is a kind of doomsday that's coming. And I almost feel also this kind of eagerness to usher it in, because then you are able to be more responsible for your own life, whereas now so much of life has almost moved beyond our apprehension. Mm-hmm. How do we understand it? But if everything sort of began to collapse, then we could use all the food we're putting away, and we could use all the guns and bullets that we've stockpiled. We could protect ourselves. We've got a cow. We've got a couple of pigs. You know, we can. And there's this almost momentum that I feel in, for instance, rural Idaho, that we are getting ready, and we will be more ready than those people in the cities will ever be. It could be true. I don't know. But I don't feel the same feeling in urban environments. I don't know how much time you're spending in cities these days, but you've written very powerfully in your fiction about cities. And what is your relationship or feeling about urban environments? How do you, is it something you think that you can write about, or is most of your concern right now with the natural world?
Well, I'm concerned about this this kind of doomsday preparation and this terrible the terrible split that we have in this culture, and I'm concerned. The novel that I'm working on, the Blue Sevens, has a sort of apocalyptic part with it, and it has to do with a sort of those elements that feel that they need to take over the country and put it in a different direction. They headed out for the hills, and they're in all the hills. They're in Idaho, they're in Arizona, they're in New Mexico, they're in Ohio. I'm very afraid of what might happen, and one of the parts, Turquoise Ledge, started out as a really fat manuscript, and then we edited it down. I like to do that sort of carve out of a block of manuscript. But one of the things that I had included in the big block that we threw out was a very strange, it was a Xeroxed manifesto, single-spaced, and it was from someone who believed that George Bush was to the left, George W. Bush, and thought that he was, and that, you know, and then it went from there, right. And it was very strange, and it called linen, so you had to sort of keep from laughing, but it's deadly serious, and this person, I imagine, is now up in the hills with these others. So I'm concerned. I'm very concerned about that, and at the same time, I'm concerned about the demonization of the people who are coming up from the South. I'm very concerned because most of the poor people that come up from Mexico are Indians, or part Indian, and that the demonization of the undocumented immigrants is crypto-racism. And if we tolerate the killing and mistreatment, which now in our federal detention centers is going on, we're condoning a kind of subtle racism. I say that the Indian Wars have never ended, and especially to the South. And I'm very concerned now that in Pinal County, which is the county next to Pima County, where Tucson is, there's a county sheriff named Babu, who allows the neo-Nazi party to patrol the desert with their guns looking for undocumented immigrants, and that something horrific and terrible is fomenting itself, and that indigenous people, Indian tribes and Indian people this side of the border may not understand that these are our sisters and brothers, and you may not understand that the anti-immigrant rhetoric is really just a mask of the ugliest, most vicious racism aimed at indigenous people. These are Indian people coming up from Mexico. They speak the same, their languages are in the same family as Hopi and Laguna. And last night in Seattle, Sherman Alexie talked about the homeless Indian man that the police shot down and killed. And the what we have to remember and understand is if any living being and any human beings are relegated into the category of illegal or alien, as soon as those people are dealt with, the voracious hatred will turn on the next group and the next group.
Yes, it doesn't really matter who the next group is, whether they're gay people or whether they're women who
Exactly. You know, women who look too independent.
Whatever. So, yes, it's a... Yeah. Well, before we turn it over for questions from the audience, I just want to say, you mentioned Sherman Alexie, and I always think of his quote on your first novel, Ceremony. I love Sherman's writing, and I think he's just a wonderful truth-teller, and I feel the same way about you, but I wanted to say that I think Ceremony is one of the most beautiful novels of the 20th century, and that if you haven't read it, I highly recommend it to you. It's a novel of just sublime, exquisite wisdom and beauty. It's probably one of the most powerful anti-war novels, even though it doesn't deal directly with war. And I'm very excited to think of you working on another novel. Blue Seventh, did you say?
Blue Sevens. It Blue refers Sevens. To the 777 on the slot machine.
Oh, that's great.
At the casinos.
That's great. And that, you know, we have that to look forward to, another novel, which, from what you've just said, will deal with some of these things that we've talked about that are just so troubling. And so that's. I was going to ask you what you were working on next, but now we know.
Yes.
Do we have some questions from the audience? Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, you want to hear in the front, please?
You said that writing a book for 10 years changes you, and that each of the books you've written has changed you. And I was just curious to know how you feel you've been changed and how those changes have changed or shaped the trajectory of the stories you want to tell and the way you write.
Well, I don't yet fully appreciate how much the Turquoise Ledge has changed me. It takes a while, but I can truly say that I noticed it most after Almanac of the Dead, because of course it was 10 years, and I really valued solitude much more. And of course, that was after years and years and years of 6-7 hours a day alone. Sometimes I don't realize the effect of the previous book until I start working on the next book. And so so now I can't really say what the difference will be here. But the changes are very subtle, I think. With Almanac of the Dead, it was really obvious. I really felt myself turn away from large groups, and I really began to cherish solitude. And you can see how that led to the time that I spent alone in order to be able to write The Turquoise Ledge. But of course, Gardens in the Dunes comes after Almanac. And I think that novel, in some ways, writing Gardens in the Dunes, well, I always write novels to find out what I don't know, or to find out what I really think about something. And when I finished Gardens in the Dunes, well, I remember when I wrote the last line, and I knew it was ended, and I cried. I just loved those characters so much. And that was the danger in Almanac of the Dead, one of the reasons that I had to wind it up, that after 10 years with them, they began to be more interesting and exciting than living people. That's a danger. But with Gardens in the Dunes, I wept to leave Sister Indigo and her sister. But the other thing that really, really was crushing was I stood back and realized that almost more than 100 years later that nothing had changed in Arizona. And sometimes I think that Gardens in the Dunes is, for me, when I step back and think about what I learned from it, you know, that the way Indian people are treated in Arizona, the way water is being stolen and moved and transferred, all of those things, I was shocked to realize. And so I think in some ways what I learned from writing Gardens in the Dunes was that certain things in the Southwest just haven't changed at all, really. And I didn't expect that, you know. And it sobered me. And sometimes I think that's one of my saddest novels, just because of how things are even now. And so so those are some, you know, some of the ways that I can see the direction. And of course, as I said, I don't yet know what all the effects of the Turquoise Ledge will have, but I'm sure over time I'll start to find out.
Yes.
This is a comment to how popular you are. This year at Indian Market, one of our local bookstores collected works, invited many Native American authors to Santa Fe. They also had a tent at the market where you could purchase books written by Native Americans. We had Sherman Alexie, Lucy Tapahanso, and N. Scott Mamade. But the most amazing thing listening to these three particular people was that they singled you out as being one of the most influential Native American authors. Lucy particularly emphasized that you were her mentor.
Oh, that's so kind. I didn't know that. Thank you for telling me. I didn't realize that happened.
So not only, as you can see, the following here, but it is with your peer group.
Thank you. Thank you for telling me.
Yes, right down here in front.
Hello. It's such a pleasure to hear you in person after reading your books for years. My question has to do with, I read an interview that you did after Almanac of the Dead where you said that you felt you'd spend so much time alone writing it that you felt like the spirits were speaking through you at times in order to write that novel. And after reading that, I read Ceremony and it made sense that Ceremony was a kind of precursor to Almanac of the Dead. Mm-hmm. But the question or the comment has to do with the kind of spirit world. You don't shy away from talking about the darkness or the dark energies that are so present in Ceremony and in Almanac of the Dead, and this sort of balance that people have to try to find living in between those two energies. Uh-huh. I guess I just wanted to know if maybe you could say a little bit more about what that was like for you to have to channel both of those kinds of energies and put it into these words.
Well, when I wrote Ceremony, I was having a very difficult time in my life. I'd left Arizona and was living in southeastern Alaska where it rained, and I got, what is it called, that seasonal depression, and I was married to John Silko then, and all of his family hated me. I was very far from home. I wrote Ceremony to save my own life, I felt, or my own psychic life. When I started Almanac of the Dead, I didn't realize what it was going to be. So I just blithely started out. In fact, I told people I thought I would write something that they could sell at the supermarket. I thought I would write something that would make some money, and then I would have time. You know, this is how my conscious plans go. Something that they would sell at the supermarket. An easy read, you know, something quick. And someone told me, for your second novel, you ought to make it, you know, something simple and easy. So I said, right, you know. So that's what my conscious mind wanted to do. So I started out, and then gradually, things began to turn. And then I would work. I remember the day that I typed the part about one of the characters in Almanac, she can the psychic one, and she gets inside the mind of a serial killer that goes and digs up and looks at the corpses of the little boys he kills. And I looked at it, and in those days I had an old Selectric 2 IBMs, and I looked at what I had just written, and I was aghast. It was like, where did that come from, you know? And that was the beginning of my sense of, what is this? What's going on? It got to the point that when I would go home, when I went home, I wanted to ride my horse. He was a wonderful Arabian gelding. His name was Hudson. I didn't name him. His registered name was Hudson Bay. I called him Hud. And I remember the day I came home from working on one of these things where I was saying, my God, you know, where did this come from? Or later on, don't let this be true. Let me be proven wrong. Let me be called a fool. When I'd been working on sections like that in Almanac, and I went to saddle him up, and he loved me and I loved him. He didn't want me to ride him, that I had something. And then I later on remembered what Zora Neale Hurston wrote in her wonderful book about the Native American African synergy of the Vodun or Voodoo religion in the Caribbean, and where some of the followers would say that the spirits come down and they ride, you know, they ride me like a horse. And so the title of Zora Neale Hurston's wonderful work is called Tell My Horse. And I felt like I was the horse. But interestingly, because horses are very sensitive, he would not let me ride him. The whole time I was, you know, for 10 years working on Almanac of the Dead, he couldn't, the horse couldn't tolerate the kind of leftover energy that was in me. This is after I'd been riding all day, and I go home and I thought, I remember that first day, I thought, oh, I will ride my horse. And he wouldn't let me because I had some residual energy or something that he just couldn't handle.
And horses just read you so
yes,
well.
They
and
do.
Again, in your book, the idea that silent communication with wild animals. We humans want to blab at things constantly, but they communicate.
They feel
so
it.
They feel, yeah. I think we have time for maybe one more question, if we have one. Yeah, down here, I think.
First of all, Ms. Soko, it is indeed a great pleasure to have you here with us today.
Well, thank
and
you.
You're such a gifted person.
Thank you.
I was wondering, I'm a collector of Hispanic women authors and Native American women authors, and I collect about probably 80, so it's a pretty substantial number.
Wow, that is.
And I'm very familiar with many of the writers. But do you see any emerging writers coming along in Native American emerging writers? I don't know that I see very many emerging writers.
Well, Sherman Alexie talked about that last night, and Sherman feels the same way as you do, that he feels that there's kind of a a stalemate. And I don't know whether that's... I suggested that maybe it isn't just with Native American authors, but in general, the scene in this country, it seems to me, is perhaps that way. But just recently, I've come across a couple of wonderful California... and you'll know them, Deborah Miranda, the poet, and Janice Gould. And they're both people, their tribes are called were called the Mission Indians. And in my research, I noted that in, 1700, there were 1 million Indians here in the state of California. And in 1900, there were 25,000. So that's a very... disturbing legacy, but the beauty of their poetry is really astonishing. And I don't mean to just push them, put them over others. There's even younger writers than they. The other night in Tucson, at one of my reading at Antigone Books, the Red Ink. Red Ink is the name of the Native American literature magazine from the University of Arizona, and a band of about 15 Red Ink members showed up. And so I think that there's a healthy group of upcoming writers, but I point to Deborah Miranda and to Janice Gould because I think they're breaking out now. And Deborah Miranda's book is called Bad Indians. And it's beautiful because it's got her poetry in it, but it's a memoir. But she also goes to the newspapers in the area where her people were, and has material. She's done wonderful research and researched the newspaper articles on the bad Indians. And then she also went to the archives of the Catholic Church, because once a year, all of the priests at the missions in California had to send in a report that answered 6 questions. And what Deborah was interested in was child abuse and things like that, how they sort of leaked in to indigenous culture in California. And so it's a wonderful book, and I'll just tell you quickly the horrifying part of that that has stayed with me, and that was that one of the questions that the priests were asked to report on was, how do your Indians discipline their children? And in the first 10 or 15 years, Deborah said, when you read through the reports from the missions, the priests write things like, "Oh, these Indians, they idolize their children. They won't lay a hand on them. They let them do anything. We have to whip their children." And then 10 or 15 years pass, and the letters say to that question, "The Indians are doing better. They still can't bear to whip their children, but they bring their children to us, and we whip them." And then a few more years pass, and they report, "The Indians are doing very well now. They whip their children." So anyway, that book should be coming. If University of Nebraska, I told Deborah, if the University of Nebraska Press doesn't publish this book, they're idiots. So I think that book will be coming, and Janice Gould's new book of poetry is coming from the University of Arizona Press. And I'm so ashamed, I can't remember the title of it, but it's got dreamers in the title. So I do think that we have plenty of people coming up, and I think it's more a malaise of publishing in general in this country, and not so much just with Native American publishing. But I think there's wonderful things happening, and even outside of Native American writing, but the publishing industry is in a transition. And so right now it's a little bit difficult to see.
Well, we're so grateful to have your works, Leslie, and your example for other emerging writers of all stripes. And we thank you for coming tonight and sharing your stories with us.
Well, my pleasure, Judah. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.